Welcome to Two-Way Street. To state the obvious, blacksmith Mark Hopper and menswear designer Sid Mashburn expressed their creativity in two very different fields using very different media. Hopper uses fire, brute force, and finally subtle manipulation to shape his metal creations. Mashburn works with pliable cottons, silks, and wool, his pieces painstakingly assembled with needle and thread. Add RuPaul to the mix, and you have an artist of a very different sort, a performer whose work challenges expectations about gender, who constantly surprises and delights us with the way he drapes and ornaments his own body. We're going to talk to Mashburn and RuPaul later in the show, but first, Mark Hopper. He grew up in England and Wales, learned his craft in London, and now has a studio at the Goat Farm, a 19th-century complex of industrial buildings on Atlanta's west side. What in the world made you decide to become a blacksmith?
I was horrible in school. I'm heavily dyslexic, so the likelihood of me becoming a research scientist like my two parents was pretty low. But fortunately, both my grandfathers were tradesmen. My paternal grandfather was a machinist engineer, and my maternal was a cabinet maker. So from an early age, I got very much involved in hands-on things. I found my joy in creating. And then when I was at boarding school, I was working on a woodworking project, and I wanted some metal components to go with it. And it turns out my woodworking teacher in his previous life before becoming a teacher was in fact a farrier.
Before we go too much further down the line, let's make sure our listeners know a farrier is the person who shoes horses.
Correct.
Makes horseshoes and then puts them on the horse.
Yep. So he as a farrier had, you know, some great skills in hot working metal, and I kind of went under his wing a little bit further on the metal side. He introduced me to the forging, the anvil, the stake works, and it kind of struck my soul. Up until then, woodworking was fantastic. I loved it. I loved joinery. I loved carving. My family would be sitting around reading books, and I'd be sitting in the fireplace whittling. But then I suddenly found metal. Suddenly finding this medium which the rest of the world considers solid and finite and as is, I suddenly get to treat it as a plastic medium. And you can manipulate it and pull it and twist it and stretch it and do all these remarkable things. And I fell in love. And that was kind of the start of the downfall. And from then on, it was like, this is what I want to do.
I am fascinated by the fact, as I was preparing for you, I was doing some research. And I found that what may be the first reference to essentially a blacksmith comes in Genesis.
Yes.
Genesis, you know, a descendant of Adam and Eve, Tubal Cain.
Tubal Cain, yeah.
And the verse, it's Genesis 4:22, is he became an expert in forging tools of bronze and iron. That's remarkable.
Yeah. To me, that's one of those things that absolutely inspires me, because we have this historical religious account, as it were, but it's essentially a historical account of the creation of the tabernacle. And it's incredible. If you read it as a metal worker, as a metalsmith, a tinsmith, a bronzesmith, or a jeweler, it discusses the creation of all these items. Our trade hasn't changed since then.
So when you talk about the tabernacle, you're talking about the housing for the Holy Script, for the Bible, for the what became the Torah eventually.
Yeah. So they talk about everything from the tops for the tent poles, and the iron rings, and the silver goblets, and the giant bronze, you know, when it became to Solomon, the giant bronze lakes, I think they described them as, these massive vessels, huge bronze pillars. And they actually went out into the desert and carved these molds in the desert. And if you actually look at the dimensioning of this, it's huge. I mean, bronze pillars with bases on them that are as near as large as this room. And, you know, 30, 40 foot tall with pomegranates and chains and, you know, all this grandiose decoration upon it. And we still do that today. Maybe not as beautifully as they once did. But it hasn't changed. Our trade hasn't changed. We still heat it, cast, forge. You know, it's incredible.
It's interesting to think about the role of the blacksmith in history. Because when I think of blacksmithing, is that the right way to say it?
Blacksmithing, blacksmithery. I prefer blacksmithing. Blacksmithery sounds a little pretentious in my world.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. You go back in history, and the blacksmith was in many ways the center of community life.
Absolutely.
In many countries. The blacksmith was a tool maker, of course, and an engineer, but dentist, doctor, undertaker,
so
did veterinary work. Probably, I assume, because of the farrier aspect of it brought him in contact with horses. And the blacksmiths were often elected public officials.
Yep.
Interesting.
Also, they would officiate weddings. So pretty much your blacksmith became this hub of, and if you go to the old towns and villages, you'll often find on the center square, there's your blacksmith shop, you've got your pub, you've got your center green, you've got the green grocers. Absolutely one of the primary characters within an old village.
How would you imagine that that happened? Everybody needed, I assume, the blacksmith service in one way or another, but they also needed the green grocer and others. But the blacksmith took on this aura almost of a magician.
Who knows quite how it happened? And if you read in medieval accounts, they refer to them almost as alchemists and the such. And there becomes this bubble around them. They were very secretive of their trade. They didn't just pass it on willy-nilly. They chose and picked their apprentices and grazed them up to the right level and then kind of passed them on. So if you think about it, if you needed something in that kind of culture, you had to literally go through the blacksmith. And the blacksmith said, no, you didn't get it. So you kind of had to schmooze him a little bit, it would seem. So perhaps it was really good manipulation in politics. I've got a skill, you guys need it, so you better give me love.
Well, I thought about this notion of the blacksmith as the center of a community when I thought about what you're doing at your shop. You're creating a community around blacksmithing right here in Atlanta.
Originally, when I started my shop and my local guild found out that I might be interested in teaching, they really, you know, they were pushing me, you know, start teaching, start sharing the knowledge. You learned from, you know, an interesting place being in Europe and it's studied under some good smiths and now it's kind of time to pass it on. I always felt it was important. I got to learn a skill at the feet of people who were just really quite incredible. And they passed it on to me. And if nothing else, I should pass it on to the next generation, at least a little bit. And in so doing, you build this environment where in the modern world, we're kind of going full circle. In the modern world, so few people actually make, so few people create. And there's this itch in people's soul to do that. And
well, the maker movement is all about that.
So then you get people coming into this community and, you know, at the goat farm, we're always kind of intermingling with each other and there's always skill sets that we share. But also with the students, they start coming in and learning from you and all of a sudden you are a hub. And you're a hub of knowledge and other people come with knowledge and they start disseminating that knowledge out to the community as well. And that's what we should be doing as people who have skills and trades. We should pass it on to the next generation, even if it's in the smallest amount.
What I think is interesting about your place at the goat farm is that while I could come to you and learn ever-increasing skills as a smithy so that I could do more and more intricate work, you also essentially have something, what do you call hammer therapy. which I think sounds more basic.
Hammer therapy was kind of a a fun idea. Originally, it started with just friends and acquaintances coming down, and we'd get together and on a Friday evening and sling a hammer and, you know, chat and catch up. And then when we started teaching classes, it was an absolute necessity. We have people who are afraid to enter the class environment because they're like, oh, I'm not ready, I haven't got any skill sets. And so, well, we're creating classes intended for you with no skill sets come in. But I understand that. Come in, experience the environment. And then also for those who are already doing classes to come in and develop their skill sets further, practice the things that they've learned in class. Or just for somebody needs to purge their demons at the end of a week, which is perfectly acceptable
you
behavior.
Said in an interview that you gave to Project Woodchips,
yes,
a magazine, an online magazine.
Yeah,
it's a great place to meet other lunatics who are tinkering and playing too.
Yes, and it's lovely because we all have our particular passions. My passion is absolutely toolsmithing. I love toolsmithing. I get to make the things that another craftsman or artisan can then go and use as their everyday tool. That's just magnificent.
Could I ask you, how many people are you getting? How are people using swords these days?
I think they're more wall hangers. There are a very strange group that do gather together and beat each other half to death with swords.
When we think of blacksmithing, we think of guys like you who are, you're a muscular guy, and we think of it as kind of a crude brute force.
Yes.
In fact, you're wearing a necklace that I assume you created.
Yes.
And it is not the result of brute force. Tell us about that. I call it a necklace. Do you call it that?
It's
a neckpiece.
It's a torque.
A took.
Torque. TORQUE or TORC or from the word of to twist.
Okay.
Torque,
I get it.
Torcus.
Tell us about it.
So, kind of reverting back to the childhood that I had and that moment where dyslexia was definitely being a bit of a burden in my life, and the kind of world of the ancient was really getting very interesting to me. I was spending a lot of time in museums, looking at artwork, looking at metalwork. One day I went into the British Museum and there was an exhibit of Celtic Bronze Age metalwork. And, you know, I must have been 9, 10, 11, somewhere in that ballpark. And, you know, as the British education is taught us through Oxford and Cambridge, it was very much at that time when I was a child that the Celtic peoples were very primitive and kind of running around in bear skins and all this kind of stuff. And they were, you know, just Luddites. And I suddenly see this metalwork, which varied, you know, some of it went up to the Pictish area in the kind of 11th, 12th, 13th century. And some of it went back to 1000 plus BC. And it was just the most exquisite metalwork I've ever seen. And it spoke to me in a manner. And, you know, I grew up, you know, part of my time in Cornwall, part of my time in Wales, through the north of the British Isles. So you're very much surrounded by that old world of stone circles and beautiful Celtic crosses and all these kinds of things. And my family being of that lineage as well. I got to see this work that changed my mind about my ancestors. And it was at that moment where I was starting to get into the woodworking and later into the metalworking, I said, one day I will learn these skills and I will make myself one of these and I'll wear it every day. And I've worn it every day since I made it.
It's gorgeous.
Thank you.
Absolutely beautiful. And I'm wondering if the buttons on your leather vest you made as well.
My belt buckle. Yeah.
It becomes your child. It becomes your friend.
To be clear, there is virtually nothing that you do that could not now be done by machine.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be as sexy.
But my point is, you talked about being a maker before. Despite the fact that modern technology can do all of this, it must be just remarkable for you to think about the fact that in your work, you are in touch with a history of craftspeople that goes back thousands of years.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, really. Poking a hole in a hammer hasn't changed since they started poking holes in hammers. You know, before that, they wrapped them, you know, wrapped the handle around. But it hasn't changed. Our tools haven't changed that much. Each person has their own particular way of doing it. And that's the only difference I can say between a machine-made tool and a handmade tool. I can change the nuance of my hammer or whatever tool it might be. I go, oh, you know what? This run, I want to put an extra 2-3 ounces forward in my hammer. And most people are like, well, you know, what's an extra 2 or 3 ounces forward on the hammer? But it could be everything. I could change the way that I make the handle. When, you know, change the swelling. How does it push my hand? Does it allow my hand to sit at the back? Does it allow me to travel up and down as I need to? When I register my hand on the hammer, am I completely aware that my hand is in lineation with the face or whether it's turned 90 degrees, 180 degrees? As I forge mid-swing, I'll flip my hammer to cross-peen, to face, as I need it. I need to be able to reference that. So, you know, that is missed in the manufactured tool. I don't think somebody who is manufacturing purely for the design concept, and you've got to remember these designs have come down from their blacksmith ancestors, as it were, and they've kind of finally said, okay, Stanley, this is the hammer we're making, you know. But we get to change that. And it was interesting in kind of reversion back to my childhood as a smith and learning smithing in relation to manufacturing. My very first hammer was a 2-pound Stanley ball peen. And that's what they requested us to have at smithing college. And I walk in, and our first day, Mr. Lloyd comes in and says, all right, lads, first thing we're going to do is shape our handles. And it's like, okay, of course. Nobody thinks to do this. The first thing you do, get that nasty shellac off the handle. You want that handle to breathe. You want it to wick the sweat away from your hand.
The wood handle. Yeah.
Wooden handle, absolutely. And he taught us how to shape those handles so that they felt absolutely perfect in the hand. And you suddenly have a whole new appreciation for that handcrafted, because suddenly you look at the world around you, instead of being a consumer and accepting of the ergonomic mediocrity, because you've got to remember the whole ergonome structure is purely based upon this ergo norm. Mm-hmm. And the chair will be this high because the average person is this size and so on and so forth. Thus, the same with hammers. Your hammer handle or your knife handle is generic. The first thing you should do is make it fit you. If it isn't right, change it. Change your world. Yeah. So anyway, I might have ranted a little
bit. No, that's fine. That's fine. Will your art be around in 100 years? Are there young people coming to learn from you? And are there young people coming to smithies around the world who want to continue this art?
Absolutely. Blacksmithing, I cannot see it going away. If there's two huge veins, there's the vein of thought that we have to keep these ancient crafts alive to not only keep it alive, but also to create beautiful things into the future. There's also those who are just running headlong away from modern culture and society. and of course, you know, in certain parts, you know, we in the Western world kind of look at this as madness. You go to third world, second world countries, it's an absolute paramount.
Yeah.
You know, you have to do this. You need a blacksmith in your village. Otherwise, village doesn't happen.
During our conversation with Mark Hopper, we discussed the buttons, belt buckle, and toque he created and wore into our studio. You can see photos of all those items on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. Let's take a break right now. When we come back, we'll talk to menswear designer and retailer Sid Mashburn.
I had a dream. Last night, while I was laying on my bed. was turning red. I saw a sign in the sky. I have come to set you free.
Welcome back to Two Way Street. On today's show, we're featuring conversations with three different kinds of Georgia artist craftsmen. If you missed our conversation with blacksmith Mark Hopper, you can find it on our podcast. But now we're going to talk with Georgia menswear designer and retailer Sid Mashburn. Last year, GQ called Mashburn the best-dressed man in the American South. And the magazine had high praise for his retail store, which is located right next door to the women's wear shop run by his wife, Anne. GQ said Sid Mashburn is a clothing store, yes, but it's also a cathedral of style, a place where the suit is holy, service is sacred, and community is practiced and built. Mashburn opened his Atlanta store in 2007. He spent many years working as a designer for some of the top names in the business: Ralph Lauren, Tommy Hilfiger, J. Crew, Land's End, and others. And while he scored successes working for them, it was his Atlanta store that really put him on the fashion map. I started by asking Mashburn how a small-town Mississippi boy developed such a great fashion style.
I was born in 61. Okay. I wrote a letter to my sister in November of 71. She was at the University of Southern Mississippi. Both of them had gone there. And I wrote her a letter saying, can you find me some green pants and a puka shell necklace? I'm nine. Okay. And my parents were a little bit like, what's up with that? They were a little bit scratching their head, but not really. I mean, they were just rolling with it.
Yeah.
After that, I go to college. I'm in my second year at Ole Miss, and I'm struggling to really, you know, the courses I like, I do well in, and others I do horribly in. But I'm having a good time and enjoying life and growing up a little bit. But I asked my dad if I could go to design school in New York, and in his inimitable Southern way, he's like, son, I'll help you go to regular school, and then you can do whatever you want. And I was like, oh, that doesn't sound great, but okay.
Was there a Southern style of dress when you were a teenager, or do Southerners dress the way everybody dresses?
It wasn't obvious, because you thought that was the world of dressing, except for when I would open GQ and go, oh, this looks cool. And then I would picture myself in that, and then I'd go buy it.
What would it have been?
Do you remember the era of sort of the David Bowie sort of early 70s baggies, platform shoes? Okay, that's what I was into. I can remember going to the first boy-girl party, mm-hmm. where you really knew it was a boy-girl party. In the seventh grade, it was at a girl that went to another school's house, and I wore baggies and a baseball shirt, which the baseball shirt back then was like a Johnny collar, short sleeve with a banded bottom. It was pretty cool for, you know, Mississippi in that era. And platform shoes. I had two pairs of platform shoes.
Wow.
I had a blue patent leather and white patent leather. So you're probably going, really? But anyway, it was very...
John Travolta.
Kind of. It was around... It was actually even pre that era.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So you did go off to New York.
I did, and this is what was cool about what my father, because they'd given me a car in college, and it was a Monte Carlo. Okay, so when I graduated from college, he said, you see that Monte Carlo? I said, yeah. He said, why don't you sell that, and that's yours, and go to New York and see if you can figure it out. So the 2 years before, when he told me, don't do this, now he was saying, okay, you can go do this. You've kind of passed the test. He didn't put it like that, but he was kind of, he was a pretty open-minded guy, my dad. And, you know, he had friends of all sorts and was very, very cool. And also, he liked clothes a lot. So I went to New York with straw in my hair and, you know, about $5,000 in my pocket, and got a job first in food. I was a horrible maitre d', then got recruited by a guy named Robert Lighton, who had a company called British Khaki that I loved. I really thought this was great. He gave me a job as a salesperson, but he taught me how to design.
Does everybody across the country, without regard to certain beachwear, say in Southern California, dress pretty much the same these days?
No. I would suggest that your Northwestern dresser is a different sort of dresser. And forget the idea that sort of that's, you know, arguably the birthplace of grunge. Not that everybody dresses like that or like a lumberjack. I mean, that wasn't the original hipster outfit that came from there. But even the people who dress up there dress a little bit differently. New York, you get a little bit of everything. I think in California, like you said, is a much more casual culture. Besides the beachwear, just everybody to dress up. They don't even wear very many ties out there. The South has always, you know, there's, I think you can find, if you go online, the constant debate about Southern prep versus Ivy League and who really was the progenitor of that. And it doesn't really matter to us. We just like certain things that also stand the test of time. Unfortunately, I think that the term preppy becomes pejorative, but it's actually just kind of more of a pointing to something that's super classic, that's right in any sort of setting. And that's kind of what our look is about. We like for it to be appropriate for any setting. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
You've said essentially that to you, preppy is basically, as you point out, a classic look, but it's also maybe having something a little bit askew. The pocket square is wrinkled. The necktie, what?
I don't study tying my tie in the mirror in the morning. I just do it, and I'll take a quick look at it and go. And I think for men, for me, I don't want to look. I want to take as few shots in the mirror as possible. I just kind of want to make sure my hair's combed back and I don't have anything that's too distracting.
Yes, but that's also a look, Sid. That's not just, oh, I don't care. It's a cultivated look to some extent. The tie that you're wearing, the tail is longer than the, what do you call this part, the front?
The apron, yeah.
The apron.
Yeah.
That's a fairly, I mean, you do that with some intention, right?
Not especially, no.
Okay.
Because you know what? Yesterday, I don't think it did that. And tomorrow, who knows? So
see, I can't do it because ties are never long enough for me.
Yeah,
I mean,
you're
I've got
a tall
long
guy,
waist.
Long torso.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my ties are always, that tail is always like.
Yeah, well, and also for guys who have a shorter torso, they wrap the tie twice on a four in hand so that they don't have that problem.
Okay, but let's go back to that in general. Preppy is classic, but with a little, some casual aspect.
Sure.
Maybe you're not wearing socks. Do you ever wear socks anymore?
I do. I'm wearing them today, but oftentimes I don't. I just like not wearing socks. But sometimes I wear, particularly with shoes like this, with really, you know, sort of serious dress shoes, I'll put socks on.
If you're going to the Metro Chamber of Commerce to give a talk to business leaders, would you be comfortable going in there without wearing a suit without socks?
It depends on if it's 95 outside and I'm wearing a khaki poplin suit, I'll wear some loafers without socks.
Okay.
Particularly if it's a Thursday or Friday, if I'm heading into the weekend. So I am super conscious of the setting I'm going into. And really, Bill, in a funny way, minding my manners.
Yeah.
Like I want to be respectful of where I'm going.
Yeah.
Okay. So if I'm going to an older person's funeral and it's going to be mostly older people, I'm wearing socks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
For my dad's funeral, I didn't wear socks.
Yeah. Let's talk about slacks. Southern boys wear their pants too short.
Not
what do
really.
You call that look? The gator?
High water?
High water.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So there's a rationale we have about that.
Okay.
And sometimes mine feel a little shorter than they should, but I really would prefer that than having them too long.
Because?
Because when you wear them too long, it makes you look shorter.
So where should the bottom of my, in this case, jeans, my slacks, where should they hit?
If I just met you for the first time, okay, and you came in my store, and I've got a guy that who's a very, very, very successful lawyer here in town who wanted our look, and I was like, no, you really don't. And he insisted that he did, and then I spoke to his wife months later, and she's like, he never wears those pants, okay? And we told him that you shouldn't do that. And we're not there to dictate, but we are there to shape and guide, okay? So we prefer for ourselves, all the guys in the store, like no break in trousers, okay?
And that's for everything, including one of your, say, $7,000 suits.
Yes, for a particular guy. Now, if I'm a guy who maybe works in Washington, okay, since you discussed Washington, or I'm a lawyer who travels around the world, and a lot of people in Atlanta travel a lot, I would probably suggest a very light break, okay? Just something that touches the top of your shoes and has a slight break to it. And that way you still get a pretty clean line, because mm-hmm. that's our rationale again, is you're looking for an uninterrupted line in what you're wearing.
That makes sense.
Okay?
Speaking of that, you mentioned when you were first designing, I asked you about sewing, and you said, well, no, I could describe how it should look. And you talked about, even back 20 years ago, skinnier pants.
Yes.
I was probably married for 10 years before my wife finally said to me one day, if the next pair of slacks you buy have pleats,
you're done.
I'm leaving you.
Well, when we came to Atlanta, I think I got a joke that it was the official pant of Atlanta.
All right.
Was the pleated khaki.
But that's all part of the same thing, isn't
yeah.
it?
Well, this is the thing is for us, you know, my big fashion influences, besides my sisters and my brother, who of course got best dressed when he was in high school, and he was a fantastic dresser. He's a very small guy. And so at that time, the guys who were shaping fashion to me were the I Spy guys, the men from Uncle, okay? Sidney Poitier in The Heat of the Night, Dick Van Dyke on the Dick Van Dyke Show. All of these guys wore a very natural shoulder, a slightly shorter jacket, clothes closer to the body, mm-hmm. okay? And what that does is it's more flattering to everybody because you lose weight without losing weight. So visually, you cut a slimmer look by having clothes that fit you. And what happens with men or with women, if they're feeling a little bit larger or overweight, they will buy bigger clothes to disguise. And actually what it's doing is it exacerbates.
So there are no such thing as pleated slacks in a Sid Mashburn store.
We do have pleated slacks.
Oh, I thought you didn't.
No, we have a single pleated, but it's pretty slim cut.
Okay.
And so it's just a slightly different look.
You build jackets differently too than if I were buying it at a big retail store. What's it called? The construction that
full canvas.
What does that mean? Full canvas.
We basically have five makes of jacket, Bill. So we have a completely unstructured or unconstructed jacket, which would be in corduroy or cotton or twill or something that's really knock around. Something. It's kind of almost a backseat jacket to have a jacket when you go to a place that says you got to have a jacket. All right. But also, it's a great place because we treat our jackets in the store like a purse. Okay. So my phone goes in the lower left-hand pocket. My keys go here. My pens go here. My glasses go here. This is a work jacket. So in a sense, it's almost like a cargo coat, okay, or like cargo pants. The second jacket we make is a half canvas. So that means the canvas, it's a piece. It's really the exoskeleton of the jacket, okay? So it's made of horsehair and wool. Okay, or camel hair and wool. And what that does is it gives you shape to your chest and gives some structure and support here, because otherwise the wool by itself could just collapse, okay? We like very, very, very little shoulder. We like to see the real man underneath the jacket.
I think men's clothes are boring compared to women's clothes.
Right.
Women are allowed to really use color, patterns. There are a lot of ways in which women can really make a statement with their clothes. Now, I understand within certain parameters, you make a statement with your clothes, clearly, but it's harder. I mean, I wear happy socks from Bloomingdale's when I wear socks because it's the only place I can do something
to express
really
yourself.
Fun.
Right.
our men's clothes just inherently never going to be as interesting as
Well, this is the thing is when a guy comes in the store, you have to kind of, you know, there's a couple of things. When a man walks into our store, your EQ has to be pretty strong if you're going to take care of him. So you got to sense immediately, is this guy in a hurry? Because if he's not, I'm going to offer him a cold drink or a hot drink and let him just wander and sit down and check his text and enjoy himself. Otherwise, he says, I'm catching a plane. I need a shirt and tie. And you got to sense that immediately because you don't want to come off as, I want to push you into something too quickly. But you also have to respect that a guy needs to get in and out. Same thing comes when a guy says, this is what I'm looking for. You have to kind of sense a little bit of what his style is. And sometimes it actually can be offensive to some guys because we ask them, tell me about your life. What do you do? Do you travel? What do you know? We're looking for cultural context so we can really help him do what he wants to do. If you ask us for our prescription of what we would give a man is something that's quiet-ish, but there is a lead singer in the band, okay? Today, my lead singer is this polka dot mock tie, okay? The rest of it, and also that this is a medium blue heathered suit, but you don't want multiple lead singers in a man's outfit, okay? Women can get away with a little bit more of that, but some guys do. You know, some guys want to go that way. But another way for us to express it is, like you said, with your happy socks, boxers. You know, we'll do a lot of Liberty prints in boxers because it's underneath. So a guy still feels like he's expressing himself, but he's not showing it.
Interesting.
Okay. Ties and pocket squares are probably the most obvious way for guys, certainly in a business setting, to express themselves because we do like colorful ties a lot.
I have a Sid Mashburn pocket square with me today.
Do you like it?
I love it. Have you ever considered whether you should have some kind of logo on your clothes?
I can't tell you how many people tell me that we should need a
well,
logo.
Well, I mean, certainly.
And so
We
have, for sure. On our polo shirt, we have on the bottom of the tail, there's a SM. And on the back of our ties, some of them we embroider on the back of SM. Other than that, we don't really do that. And we've talked about it a lot. And we have a really cool little logo that my daughter did. That's Sid and Ann. It's cute. I won't say we never will,
right.
But right now it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like it's kind of earned its place.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, more with Sid Mashburn. If you spend time in Sid Mashburn's clothing store, you're going to be struck by the great variety of music the staff plays on the record player at the counter. That's another way in which Mashburn is a trendsetter. He's known for his broad range of musical tastes. I noticed that on your website right now, you are featuring the LP, the original soundtrack to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Oh, yeah, we love
Why?
It. I love Ennio Morricone.
Okay.
I mean, and how brilliant that you have this Italian guy who takes Western culture. It's a little bit like, were you an Elton John fan?
No.
Okay, Bernie Taupin and Tumbleweed Connection. You know, you've got this Englishman who's writing these Western sort of mini sagas. So music, we find a lot of messaging and life stories in, and we, our friend Alton Brown said early on, he said, when he came in the store, he's like, oh, you guys are liner notes people. It's like, yeah, we want to know the bass player.
You are so well thought of now by the national media, the New York media, that Esquire magazine actually published your top 40, your Spotify top 40 song list. And it's really diverse. Time of the Preacher, which is Willie Nelson's Redheaded Stranger, is listed as number one.
You know what's funny is that was the...
Time of the Preacher.
That song, I listened to Willie Nelson. That song became more important here. We would play that almost every morning when we opened the store. The first guy that worked for me, Randy Piles and Kwong Dao, our master tailor, who was nothing short of a gift from God. It was us three in the store. And then we hired, Randy left, and then two guys came in, Pete Samuelson and Matt Lambert, and And we were collecting albums from each other. We just brought them all together. And so I don't know if it was Pete or Matt that started playing that Redheaded Stranger, but we would play it literally every morning.
We should tell our listeners that if they're not familiar with it, that is Willie Nelson's classic concept album. It's a story.
Oh, yeah.
That record.
Absolutely. And it is, I mean, and it just, you know, it's a little bit like the way we treated the Miles Davis. It was kind of blue, almost like you could put it on a loop. And it, every time you listen to it, there's something new that kind of comes out of it.
Howlin' Wolf is on here. Killing Floor.
It's powerful.
Yeah. Well, you're a Southerner.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Southern blues. Stone Soul Picnic is on here. And the only thing I would fault you for on that is you have the fifth dimension.
As opposed to Laura
Nero. You ought to have Laura Nero, who wrote the song and who is an artist of, you know, unparalleled.
She was in the Brill Building, along with Jerry Goffin, Carole King. I mean, that talk about brilliance, unbridled. She also wrote Eli's Coming.
She wrote everything.
God,
I mean, she
was
wrote
brilliant.
Eli and the 13th Confession. She wrote Wedding Bell Blues.
Oh, Wedding Bell Blues. How fantastic.
Everybody
is that?
Recorded Laura Nero's songs.
Yeah.
And thank goodness, just a couple of years ago, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame initiated her because any female artist, particularly you talk to today, will say it was Laura Nero who influenced her work.
Right. So. Well, you know, the Fifth Dimension, though.
Good group.
They got a little bit of a bad rep. Billy Davis Jr., Marilyn McCoo.
Yeah.
I mean, how about Will You Marry Me, Bill? That's another great one.
So it's an interesting look. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to post a link to it.
Okay, fantastic.
On the website so people can hear. All right, so...
did I put Randy Newman on there?
How do you not have Randy Newman?
I don't know, but I tell you, a big record for me in high school was his Rednecks record.
Sure.
Do you know that one?
God. We're Rednecks. Rednecks.
Yeah. And that flood of 1927 and Marie.
Yep.
And a wedding in Cherokee County.
Yep. Sid Mashburn, it's just really fun getting to talk to you. Thanks for being here, Sid.
Thank you so much, Bill. You're really kind. I appreciate it.
They seek him here. They seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion.
That's fashion retailer and designer Sid Mashburn. We're going to turn our attention now to an artist who expresses his creativity in a different way from our first two guests. RuPaul is America's best-known drag queen. His TV show, RuPaul's Drag Race, which is in its ninth season, is now on VH1, where it's getting more than 1 million viewers per show. RuPaul doesn't give many interviews, so we were pleased when he sat down to talk with us about his early years in Atlanta and more. So you moved to Atlanta, you were 15 years old, I think?
And, yes.
And one of the reasons you did, because you had gone through a lot of drama at home. What does that mean?
Well, my parents had a terrible divorce, and I was really traumatized by both of them, by them together and them separately, and I had a hard time in school. So my soul sister, my older sister and her husband were moving to Atlanta, and they asked if I wanted to go with them, and I said, sure.
You know, I remember the drag scene in the 80s in Atlanta, along Peachtree Street, the clubs. You talk about 688 on Spring Street, but there were a number of clubs. So there was a community there, I assume, that you could feel safe and a part of. But what was it like in those days negotiating the larger community of Atlanta, which in those early days in the 80s was still a Southern city in many ways.
Yeah, but as you well know, Southern culture has always had a place for eccentrics in Southern culture. And you see it in the Tennessee Williams books and plays and the Truman Capote and all of the, you know, all of those. And there was always a place for the Southern eccentric. So I felt very, very comfortable. I'm born and raised in San Diego, which is very conservative Republican, especially when I was a kid. But it was completely different in Atlanta back then.
You have watched so much history. You've been part of such a sweep of important milestones, some negative, some positive, over the years, having to do with sexual identity, with sexual orientation. You watched, you were there when the AIDS epidemic began. You watched Ronald Reagan turn his back on the victims of AIDS, do nothing to try to stop the disease. You were there for things like President Clinton with his failed Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, a sort of clumsy effort to do something about gays in the military, all the way up to the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage. So if you don't mind, walk us through just a little what that history has been like for you as you've made your way through life.
You can never underestimate a culture's love affair with fear. There have been lots of great gains made for people who want to embrace love and openness. But, you know, that pendulum, I've seen it swing back and forth. I remember in the late 70s, you know, when disco and was around and people were moving their hips and dancing in a provocative way and being swept away by the spirit of the boogie. And you think, well, this is brilliant. We are, as a human race, are advancing forward and embracing the unseen and the unexplainable, which is beautiful. But just as soon as that happened, you know, people ran back to a closed mind and a closed heart. So I, you know, and then again, during the Clinton administration, I remember during interviews, people would always ask me about Will and Grace and how things are changing. And I was very cautious because I knew how I witnessed how easily people can go back to the old ways. And we're seeing that today.
You're known for a lot of different taglines, quotes, whatever. But my very favorite, I just want to talk briefly about it because it's the perfect way to end our conversation. You are known for saying, "We're born naked and
the rest is drag."
I don't know that we have to say any more than that, RuPaul. You've been a wonderful guest, and I appreciate your taking time to talk to us.
Thank you so much, Bill. You are a joy.
Friday night, RuPaul will be roasted by the contestants who've been part of his TV show this season. The roast will air on VH1. We're almost out of time for this week's show, but before we leave you, I want to remind you about the special event we have coming up next Tuesday night, May 23rd. We're going to be back at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library to record a show in front of a live audience. Our guest will be Mark Pendergrast. He's written a book called City on the Verge about the city of Atlanta. He writes that Atlanta is on the verge of tremendous rebirth or inexorable decline. He says it's kind of a petri dish for other cities struggling to reinvent themselves. We'd love to have you in the audience and for you to share your thoughts about the city of Atlanta. Admission is free. You don't need to make a reservation, but you should plan on being there before we start at 7 p.m. That's Tuesday, May 23rd at the Carter Library. And one more reminder that when you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can always subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And we archive all of our shows on our website at gpb.org/TWS. Our senior producer is the flawlessly fantabulous Jenny Ament. Jenny edited today's show. Our producer is the fulgidly far-seeing Lisa Clark, and our engineer is the formidably fulgurant Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for joining us today. See you again next week for another Two-Way Street.
I have one thing to say. You better work.